The E-Commerce Uncovered podcast is a behind-the-scenes look at what makes e-commerce a success in today's ever-growing and continually changing online world. The podcasts look to uncover the secrets of e-commerce success so you can learn and apply to your own online business. Brought to you by the co-founders of Core Fulfillment, one of the UK's leading e-commerce fulfillment providers, Paul Burns and Jeremy Vernon.
Hi, Jeremy Vernon here, and welcome to a very special episode of E-commerce Uncovered. Today I interview Neville Wright. Neville, if you don't know who he is, he sold the kiddiecare.com business to Morrisons back in 2010. And basically, just as he built the business up to the largest independent nursery business in Europe, I think it was at the time. So this is a real success story in e-commerce, and the sort of whole backstory behind it, this sort of 40 years in the making, is a great listen. A lot of this is covered in his book, which we talk about a lot. The book is called The Answer Is Yes, Now What's the Question? That's available on Amazon if you're interested in knowing more. But we cover a lot of the story here in this interview, so I'm very, very pleased to welcome Neville Wright to E-commerce Uncovered. So Neville Wright, welcome to E-commerce Uncovered, and thank you very much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
I would just like to touch on your story before we get into the more e-commerce side of things, if you wouldn't mind, of how it all started for you. You've written a book, and a lot of this is in there, but if we could just, for anyone that is not aware of who you are, The Answer Is Yes, and Now What's the Question? Obviously, the book is sat here in front of me. Would you mind just giving us a very brief overview where you started in your career, and then we'll come into a bit more detail of the e-commerce side of things.
Right. Well, it started. I came out of mainstream employment when I was 24, 1974. So that's where it all really started, and I wanted to look after myself. And The Answer Is Yes, Now What Is the Question, the title of the book, that came within the first few days of going into business. People would ask me to do a job, and because of my eagerness and willingness and desperation, so we say, to make it a success, the answer was always yes. So obviously the reason I wrote it was because, this is the title, is because the people, after a couple of weeks, they'd say, Neville, can you? And I'd say, yes, I can. And they'd go, I haven't asked a question yet. I said, no, I'll do anything that you ask. As long as it's not immoral or illegal in my eyes, I'll do anything.
And that pretty much started in sort of property and property maintenance, didn't it?
Property maintenance, window cleaning, then general maintenance, painting and decorating, and anything that I was capable of doing, and a lot of things that I wasn't capable of doing. So it was a great learning experience.
I think certainly one of the things I've taken away from the book
is... By the way, did you just hear that? There's the horses.
Yeah.
There's four horses outside.
They want to be on the podcast that was, as well.
That wasn't Dawn, who's behind the camera, making that noise.
We're in the country. It's
we
fine.
Are in
it's
the good. Country. There's four horses just outside here, some dogs and children. So you might hear some background noise.
No, that's absolutely fine.
Sorry, where was you?
No, it's fine. One thing that comes from the book is that hard work was not something you were afraid of at all.
Do you get a choice? If you want things in life, really want things that you want security, meaning you want a lot of money for 40, 50 years' time, and you want a lot of things, goals, then there is no other choice than very hard work. But you've also got to look and think, the normal person will work 8 hours a day and they survive. So you've only got to work a little bit more, an extra hour in the morning, an extra hour at night. And when they have a day off, you know, if they work 5 days, then you work 6. And all of a sudden, you become different. then it grabs you and you start working 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours at night and so on. And it gets hold of you because you can see the success.
Where do you think that mentality of effectively going the extra mile, doing the extra hour, doing the extra day came from for you?
Love.
Okay. Love of work?
No, love of my wife, okay. Marilyn. So the thing is, we wanted to work together. So we wanted to be together. So that's why we got married, obviously, you know, like most people do, I would expect. So she wanted things. You know, I was a typical boy and she was a typical girl. I thought everything was all right and I could do with nothing. It didn't matter. And she wanted things. You know, she wanted clothes and things, what girls want. And so therefore, and she wanted security. And so if I was going to be with her, I wanted to give her those things. So that's where it come from. Then the second stage is, well, she couldn't have those things because we hadn't got any money. So that was a good motivator to do something. But really, primarily, it was we was on the dole, or I was on the dole. In those days, we had a three-year-old child, and Marilyn couldn't claim dole in 1974. So there was nothing coming in, and hunger pains were primarily what drove me. So there's a secondary goal of being financially free in whatever 20, 30, 40 years time. Yeah. And there was this, I always tell people, do you mind if I just go off on a tangent? Because I used, if you've read the book, it goes back, you know, forward or sidetracked, because I get sidetracked and I remember things and I forgot what the question was just then.
What kept you motivated? What kept you doing the extra sort of hour, day? What
yes.
is it that drove
oh,
you?
Yes. I do tell people there's 50-year goals, and my 50-year goal at the moment at 68 is just to be hanging around here, you know.
Okay.
I have a 32-year goal as well, which is quite significant, and it's my birthday, and 18th of June. You're invited to my birthday party because it's going to be a big one, and this is 2050. So...
Okay, I'll put it in the diary.
That's when I'll be 100. So there is all those goals, the 10, 20, 30, 40, 50-year goals. But then there's really, they're important because you're heading there and you can't be a failure if you've got 50-year goals. Whereas a lot of people, they will trip up, they'll fail in the first 6 months and they'll say, I'm no good at business, I'm no good at this, no good at that. And they'll use it for a crutch for the rest of their life. Or my partner left me, or the bank took in the money, or they wouldn't lend me the money, I couldn't get a mortgage, and all that kind of stuff that happens. And they use it for a crutch for the rest of their life because they say, I could have been in business like you. But let me tell you the shit I've had, you know, and this is what happens. So that's why you have a long-term goal, because you can never make mistakes, only learn. You learn things what not to do in the future. I wish I'd have learned what, but there you are. You know, you can't win them all. But there's the month-to-month, week-to-week, day-to-day goals, which are serious. And then there's the hour-to-hour and really, really serious ones, a minute-to-minute. What are you doing? What are you doing this minute? You're interviewing me this minute, but is it taking you nearer to or further from your goal in life?
Hopefully closer to.
Exactly. So we're not wasting our time. The minute-to-minute goal for me now is bring me nearer to, because hopefully I am going to let more people know through your podcast about my book. I've got no interest in the money. What I have got an interest in is people to learn from a 40 years experience that I've had. They will make mistakes, everybody does, but I don't want them to make all the mistakes that I made. So therefore, I want to share my knowledge. I don't want to take it to the grave with me.
You've touched on two things there, which I'd like to talk about if you wouldn't mind. One of them is failure, an attitude to failure, and the other one is goal setting, because we've just talked about goal setting. It's obviously something you've raised quite early on in the conversation. Let's start with failure, because okay. I think...
I read somewhere, or I heard somewhere, you never class failure as failure, only a way of learning. And that I listened to, I read very early on in life. And I thought, that's good. I like that. And so, in fact, I quite like failure, because what happens is it gets the adrenaline going. You've learned something, and then you get back up and you succeed. And that succeeding after the failure is far much more rewarding than if you just floated through life succeeding all the time.
Yeah.
I embrace failure. I don't want too much of it. In fact, I don't really want any of it. Yeah. But I've failed every day of my life in some way or other. It's not a big failure, it's just small failures.
I think that's the point of difference in some ways, though, isn't it? People will get to the point of failure and go, it doesn't work, give up, lose their motivation. But it's using that failure as a stepping stone, using that failure as something, what can you take away from, what positives can I, what have I learned from this failure, and then building on that and moving forwards.
I did say something in the book about falling over and getting wet is part of life. Would you put your foot over on the stepping stone through a river if you knew you was going to fall over? And probably you wouldn't, but falling over and getting wet is part of life. And that's what you have to accept. And when we had Kiddie Care, for instance, the retail shop, those failures wanted to come quick and fast. And what I'm saying is every day we had 40-foot containers of cots, prams, pushchairs, etc. There was 1,400 pushchairs in a container. Now, you buy those from a manufacturer in Taiwan or somewhere like that, China. You really want to get those out on the market that day. Obviously, because you want your turnover, you want your profit, and you don't want stuff hanging around. But you want the first few people not to store them in the garage waiting for the child to grow up ready to use it. You want to be selling them to the person who wants to go on holiday today and push their child in the pushchair. Because if it's out for a fortnight or a month and it doesn't come back, you know it's okay. But if somebody goes on holiday for a week and they come back and they say the wheels have fell off, you can immediately take it off sale, and you may have only sold 30 or 40 of them. So failure quick is the best thing, because then you can quarantine them, get the 30 or 40 back off customers, give them a refund or whatever you want to do.
That's an actual example, isn't it, from the book? Because didn't you replace them with McLaren versions?
Oh, I did. Hey, you read the book.
I have read the book.
I had 100 Syndicos. Yeah. This was in 1980, and it was brilliant. And we sold them at $12.99, and McLarens were $18.99, and they flew out the door, and all the wheels fell off. And then they come back, and I give them new ones because the wheels had been fixed on this new batch, and then all the stitching came apart, and it was a disaster. So I give them the higher price one as in compensation. But there was a great learning curve there, and a great thing of that failure. From 1980, in our warehouses, we stamped every box that come in off the lorry with a date stamp. And every one of those would be in a warehouse in an area on their own. And the next container would come in, and that container would not be started until those date stamps were out, because you quarantine them, basically. You know if there is any problem, they're all going to come back. Whereas people who mix their stock up, it could be 5 years, you know, before, and you could carry on keeping getting this problem.
Yeah, people will do that, obviously, with food-based, you know, batch control and all that sort of stuff. But you actually did that with products just in case there were production issues.
If there's a problem, you want to know about it quick.
Yeah. Okay, great. The second, obviously, point that I wanted to come to was that you've already mentioned was the goal setting. Everyone's heard of goal setting, obviously. Some people do it, some people don't. But you've obviously gone into goal setting from anything from a 50-year goal down to a minute-by-minute goal.
Yes.
Now, not sure people will do goal setting certainly to that extent. Do you think that's helped you in everything that you've achieved to literally break everything down?
Made £100 million. Ask somebody else who's made £100 million.
Yes. And what's the question? Yeah. Okay, so, fair enough.
So, yes.
I mean, if someone doesn't goal set now, they could get overwhelmed by doing minute-by-minute goals. Yeah. How would you advise them to start?
One, if they haven't got any goals, I say no goals, no life. As easy as that. And I wouldn't know what to say to somebody if they hadn't got any goals. I could probably tell them what their bank balance is if they haven't got any goals. So when you say about minute to minute, right, I'm dyslexic. I haven't spent my life writing stuff down. And I've always tried to make lists of goals. But the minute to minute goal is in your head. Right, in this office here, there's 13 different wallpapers. It's quite nice, isn't it, really?
Yes, it's good. It's great. It's not boring.
It's different. So the thing is, those minute-to-minute goals was laying all the papers out, undoing them, spreading them all over the floor, then putting them into each section. They're the minute-to-minute things. You don't write them down. It just comes to you. If you're digging a hole, that minute-to-minute goal is get the side straight, do it properly, clear the rubble away or whatever it may be, and you're working. You're not taking your time, you're not smoking, you're not chatting, you're focused on getting that job done so you can get the post put in, the cement put in, and the fence up. You know, they're the minute-to-minute, because once you've dug your hole properly, and then you've put your post in, you've put your concrete in, and then the next one, and the next one, next one, you put your fence. So it's those are the minute to minute in your head. So you're driven. So you're driven in a way of the competition is yourself. I'm competing against myself, not against other people. A lot of people thought that when we had kiddie care, we was in competition with Tesco's and Mothercare and John Lewis and that, but we was in competition with ourselves. Can we sell the next pram that's going to be sold? Well, we can't if they don't come into the shop. So how do we get them in the shop? Once they're in the shop, can we fit what they want to them? And can we get the sale instead of somebody else? We was competing against ourselves. How good can we be? And Muhammad Ali taught me that. You see, when I was a window cleaner, Muhammad Ali was like champion of the world. And I thought he was unique and great and special, which he was.
Yeah.
And I thought I was in no way in comparison to that man. But then he said something that I realized I was just the same as him. I just had the same opportunities as him. I could do what he did. And what it was, the interviewer said, Ali, if you wasn't a boxer, what would you have been? And he said, if I wasn't a boxer, I could have done anything. I could have collected bins, garbage bins. And now that started to resonate with me, because I was kind of on that level of garbage bin collector. And he said, I'd be garbage bin collector. I'd be champion of the world. And I'm thinking, that's incredible. That's great. I would collect more bins than anyone else. Now, he's not doing it in competition with them, but he's doing it in competition with himself. I would collect more bins than anyone else, and I'd do it before my opponents got out of bed. And my world changed like that. I thought I was kind of the lowest of the low, and because I couldn't read and couldn't write, but I could collect bins. I could paint. But I all of a sudden started painting quicker. I'm the world champion painter. You know, and this is how it goes. So he taught me
to paint with two hands.
Yeah, he taught me ambidextrous. And when you probably read in the book, somebody came in to 11 o'clock. No, there wasn't. That was a different story. Somebody came in to where I was working, and I was working with two paintbrushes, and he says, "You are ambidextrous, Neville." And I says, "I'm not. I'm married." I was only I was 25, you know. And he says, "You don't know what ambidextrous is, do you?"
You just learned because you knew you could paint quick.
Yes. Yeah.
So do you think the sheer hard work that you've put in, and obviously it started, you know, cleaning windows, property maintenance, decorating. Do you say that a lot of that motivation came from, one, the minute-to-minute goal setting that you had, plus also that sort of quote from Muhammad Ali? Is that really what you thought about every time when you were thinking, I get better at this, move forwards?
Yes, I did. Because at the same time as cleaning windows, in the evenings, when you couldn't clean windows in the dark, we used to make fur fabric toys and cushions for my brother's father-in-law's market. So we used to have to cut the material up, and the scissors that I'd got, or just the amount that we did, hours and hours a night, cutting them up, made my hands red raw and bleed. I used to put bandages on them, and in the daytime, the bandages used to fall off in the cold water, and I didn't realise that they hurt until I stopped, and then the pain was there. So the adrenaline kicks in, and the need to keep on going, because you want to eat, you want to pay your bills. And I didn't want to do window cleaning all my life. I had a window cleaning business, not a window cleaning round. And it was a big difference. A window cleaning round has a ceiling. Window cleaning business doesn't. I realised very quickly I wasn't in the window cleaning business. I was in the property maintenance business. That's what I was doing. Cleaning windows is maintaining a building. So therefore, I needed other things. I needed paintbrushes. If I was going to have a better job, better paying job, I needed paintbrushes. So I needed to earn more money, not only to live, once my belly was full, basically, and I could put food on the table, then the next thing come along, am I going to stop in this? My mum used to say, Neville, you'll never settle. I'd had 17 jobs, and you say you never settle. But also she said, when I was a kid, I got some vitus dance. And it was, you know, it's a disease where you can't stop moving about. It's involuntary movement. And it's like, so therefore, I needed more money to get more tools to do better jobs, which were better paying. That's what motivated me to get out of the job I was in, to get a better job, an easier job, better paying job. And so then I was going to put guttering up, and I needed some scaffolding. So I needed to get some more money. And this is how we've accumulated it, because there's that desire and need not to settle, to keep on doing things different every single day. Yeah. And I do say in the book, if your business has not changed when you come out of it at night to what it was in the morning, then somebody else is taking your business and you're going backwards. Even if it's just a tiny bit and it's in your mind, you've got to keep on pushing. Don't be a settler.
I heard a quote the other day regarding your business, you know, leave your business 1% better than the day before, effectively, when you leave. So I guess it's all the marginal gains thing, isn't it?
It is.
Gradually just building and building and building.
It is. You don't see it on a day-to-day basis, but when you look back, then you see where you've come from.
Obviously, your business moved on. So property development, you were doing all sorts of different things, as you say, looking at putting guttering up, you were decorating. But then obviously you got to buy property. And that obviously started something, a huge chain of events for you.
The goal to buy property came first by wanted to look after ourselves because of the, maybe it was a shame of not being able to read and write. So I couldn't make a bill out for somebody. Marilyn would be in the truck with a typewriter typing the bill out when we'd finished the job. And it was the people that used to say, oh, I see you brought your wife. Does she help? And it's like they was trying to put us down because we was working as a team. And I used to think, well, Marilyn can paper a room out quicker than I can or better. So there was always that stigma there that you thought the sooner we get our own properties, the sooner we won't have these snide remarks. So the bad things in life are really good because if somebody makes a snide remark, then you ignore that as a put down, but you embrace it for motivation to come out of that area of business and leave those people behind.
Yeah. So it's a motivation.
It's a motivation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do say as well, 99% of our customers were really, really nice. And they were smashing and it made the job all worthwhile. And I'm talking about 30 odd years and 40 years taking the maintenance business into consideration as well. So for 40 years, we got verbally slapped in the face every day. It got to probably we was having 3,000 customers a day that were really, really nice. And one customer would be going absolutely loopy because they didn't get their pushchair delivered or whatever it was. And they would rant and rave down the phone and call us everything under the sun. And those people, that 1% of people, taught us how to run a good business. Because we didn't want that shouting. We wanted everybody to be happy. And so that 1% who was raving lunatics, they taught us, oh, and the people who thieved off us, the people who just did so much damage to our business, they were the ones that actually motivated us to become really good.
Excellent. So let's move on to Kiddy Care.
It's a fly around here.
So the property journey, you didn't obviously set out to become a nursery equipment retailer. You had a property, you saw the opportunity to turn it into a shop.
Marilyn was going to make it into an office so she didn't have to work at night. She'd work in the day. And then she says, well, I only have a desk and I've got this four-room terrace house, so we could do something.
So you turn it into a shop.
Secondhand prams.
Yeah, after having a child.
Yes.
You obviously decided that was a potential sort of business that you could look at.
It was cheap to start. I say easy to run. But then you realise if things are not easy, so it's challenging. And then we started with secondhand prams. And along with these prams, people used to give us clothes. So we'd have secondhand clothes. And then we had some toys. And then gradually we had the new toys and new clothes. It keeps on going and going.
And I think, again, very much a theme of your book is that you were pretty much reinvesting everything into both businesses that you had. Obviously, they sort of sat side by side, didn't they?
There was that 50-year goal of being financially secure.
At that time, what was financially secure for you at that time?
25,000. And I take that sum because that was the premium bond jackpot. And I really, up to the age of 24, thought I could, I'd got a chance of winning that. I'd got 6 £1 premium bonds. and then, of course, when I became 24 and my brain matured and I started in business, then I realised that thinking I'm going to win the jackpot was just silly. really. The only way to get the jackpot was to work at it.
Yeah.
And £25,000 in our estimate in 50 years' time, well, it would have lasted the 50 years. But obviously, £25,000 doesn't go anywhere now.
So it wasn't called Kiddycare at the time when you first started it, was it?
We called it Rainbow Warehouse. And the reason we called it Rainbow Warehouse is because we'd bought a few secondhand prams, but we didn't know where it would go. We thought maybe just secondhand furniture or junk.
Yeah.
That's it, yeah.
And the name came because you really respected Mother Care, is this right?
Oh, this was the second shop.
Okay.
So the first shop was called Rainbow Warehouse, but Rainbow meaning, you know, there's lots of things, could be anything. And then the co-op decided to open a lot of co-ops called Rainbow in this area. So okay. People used to ring us and they go, I'm not very happy with this washing machine. And go, are you not? Are you not happy with your washing machine? Well, that's a shame, isn't it? And they go, when are you picking it up?
Go, not me.
It's not us, no. And we thought, that's not the right name because they were bigger than us. We couldn't fight them on the name. So anyway, we sold that shop as a going concern.
Yeah. So then that's...
That was the first children's shop we sold.
And is that when Kiddycare name was chosen?
Yes, 1980. We thought, well, we can't have Rainbow Warehouse anymore, so we've got to change the name and got a new name. So what did we know about the nursery trade? Well, we always knew from the 60s there was Mother Care, and we greatly admired them because being in business, people used to mention Mother Care, and we thought it was the best, so something similar.
Yeah.
And that's how that name came along.
So you obviously started to build up the business. You nearly sold it at one point, is that right?
I did, yes. And Carl Davis showed me that day what passion for business was all about. He was a rep, and he used to come in on a Friday. And we used to have fish and chips from the chip shop two doors away. And we said, oh, well, we won't see you anymore, Carl. And he said, why? I said, well, there's no passing trade. And with that, he dragged me out the shop. I was 9 stone at the time. He was about 30 stone. He picked me up like a rag doll. He dragged me out the shop and he faced me down Lincoln Road, which is into Peterborough. And he says, look at that. And then he swung me round. My feet was off the ground and he showed me the other way. This is all the people coming into Peterborough. He said, you're on the main road and you say there's no passing trade. He says, it's the way you display your stuff. And he convinced me. He was talking about my shop, my life. And he says, I've seen you and Marilyn work so hard over this last year. He says, you can't give it up. He says, you're just about to make it. I said, I'm making no money, Carl. I'm making no money. So it's not for us. And he says, you've just got to stick in there. Don't give it up. And I thought, you're so passionate about my shop. And I went into the shop and I said to Marilyn, Carl just says we shouldn't pack it up. Well, she didn't want to anyway. And yet she'd never had any money in a year of working in that shop. And I couldn't say whether it'd be any better tomorrow as it was yesterday. But I went across the road within 10 minutes to the hardware store, got a lot of hooks, and I screwed them into the front of the shop because there was all terrace houses and you couldn't define whether one was an office, a shop, or a house.
Okay.
They soon defined it then because we hung everything outside and we got into trouble with the local council. But that was the start. And also, I do honestly think when I went in and I said to Marilyn, we're keeping it, I'd got to prove that it wasn't going to be like yesterday. It motivated me to actually have a positive mind. I couldn't let her down. I couldn't say, well, Carl was wrong and I was wrong. I couldn't do that. But it was like being on the dole. I said to the man in the dole, I will look after my family myself because the government can't, my employers couldn't, and you certainly can't. And it was like that was the biggest motivation to succeed, because I'd had 17 jobs. And I probably, if it was just another job after window cleaning for a couple of days, I would have packed it up. But the thought of going back, cap in hand, to that guy in the Dole office, can you imagine my embarrassment? He's going, I'm looking through the door and he's going, come on in, I knew you'd be back. I couldn't do that. So, you know, it was the same with the shop.
Yeah.
It was.
Now, you built the shop up to multiple stores, didn't you? Multiple locations.
Yes, we did, yeah.
And I think, again, one of the things that came through again in the book was how customer-centric your business is. I'm talking both of your businesses yes. here. You always had the customer in mind.
What else is there?
Not all businesses do that, though.
Is there not customers in there?
There is,
business?
But I don't think every business is as customer-centric as... You started with the customer, didn't you?
I did, yes.
And you built the business around what they needed and what they wanted.
I don't see how you don't do that, because they are the ones
don't.
That are giving you the money.
Yep.
If you don't serve the customer as a customer wants, they're not going to give you money. So therefore, you go into a restaurant, a new restaurant, you say, I'll try this. If it's not brilliant, you say, oh, it's their first night or it's the first week. And we'll leave it 3 or 4 weeks and we go back again. And if it's not brilliant, then you may say, oh, well, they've only been here a few weeks and it's a bit of teething, you know, and they've had a few staff leave and stuff like that. And then you give it another go and you go, they say, shit, this is, I'm not coming here again. And this is what happens. And when you sell a business that's really, really good, the problem is for the new people who have bought it, the customer's expectations, there's a standard. I've always been in this shop and I've always got excellent service. I've always been greeted properly. And that goes down because they have a different idea of how to serve the customer, or not, as you say, not thought about it. Well, that business is going to go downhill quick.
I'd like to come into post-sale, if you wouldn't mind, KiddyCare as well. But
right.
Can we just touch? I'd like to touch on the sort of journey that you had, sort of taking the business online. Just one more thing that, from the customer-centric point of view, that I'd like to touch on. One thing that I thought was really good for you to do. You set up free teas and coffees and sort of a cafe type setup, didn't you, in the shops?
Yes.
And also paid the travel expenses.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. What we did. Well, I always put myself in the customer's shoes. And there was that question I asked myself every day. If I was a customer, what do I want? How do I want to be treated? What do I want? So that's where it come from. And every time I went into a shop, store, whatever, filling station, wherever it was, I used to think, I am the customer. How are they treating me? And if they was treating me in not such a good way, then I think, are we doing that with our customers? Is my experience in this petrol station or this supermarket or this restaurant, is my experience what my customer is getting in our shop? So I learnt by other people. I didn't have to think of all these things. They come to you if you give yourself some time and think, was that a great experience I had? Then I will adapt that and I'll put it into our shop. Was that a crap experience I had? Do we ever do that with a customer? And if the answer is yes, we do, then that changed tomorrow. Or if it was in the afternoon, it changed today. You know, it's like they're your minute-to-minute experiences. So you do your minute-to-minute experiences as well, and your 50-year experience. So what do you want your whole business to be, you know, in all that time, in 50? Look in the long run of where your business is going to be. How are you going to get it to there? And it's not about money. Money is a byproduct of all business. So it doesn't matter. If anybody goes into business, think they're going to make a shed load of money, they ain't. If anybody goes into business thinking they're going to look after the customer, they'll probably make a shed load of money.
Right. You obviously, you went through quite significant growth, even for the shop side of things. You obviously then had the sort of growth pains that any business has. You had the multiple sites. You were, I think you were saying you were going between all the sites. You had problems with the people taking on the sites because they didn't run it as you would want it. So you were spending a lot of your time, literally, shop to shop.
I was thinking, wasting my time.
What am I doing?
Wasting my time fighting fires all the time.
So at that point, you decided to try and centralize the shop and make it like a superstore style.
What I thought, we'd got two really good superstores and then we'd got another small shop, but it was driving me mad. And I thought one day, what was the goal? I'd forgot. So the main goal, our primary goal, was to work together. That was it. So bring it back to the KISS principle of keep it simple, stupid. I was being stupid. I was expanding like everybody else was expanding in the high street. So how could we be together working as a team when actually I was in one store and Marilyn was in another? So it wasn't working properly. So you put two heads together and they're probably as good as five. Individual. So we decided that multiple stores, like everyone else was doing, was not for us. So again, we went against the grain, but you couldn't pull the people in. Like, there was a mother care store in every big town. There was going to be a kiddie care store in every big town. But we decided, because we wanted to work together and that was our main focus, that that weren't going to happen. So therefore, you say, how do you get those people in those days when there was no internet, how do you get them to travel 2, 3, 4 hours to a baby store? How do you do it? What are the objections? So the objection as a man in those days was, well, football on Saturday, I'm not going to miss that. Why should I spend my time travelling? And why should I pay for the petrol, there's expense. Yeah. Now, I can't do anything about the football, but the wife can. So the wife is now our secret salesperson, because she's now saying, you don't have to buy anything. Oh, because the other objection was, if I travel all that far, I'll have to buy something and I don't want to spend my money. So the wife was taking the objection of the petrol away, and it's free, so you don't have to buy anything. So therefore, they used to travel 2 or 3 hours. They used to queue to get in the village because it was so busy. They used to queue to get in the car park. They used to queue to get in the store. They used to queue to find an assistant to show them things. And then after 2 hours of demonstrations, the wife would say, all right, well, I know what I want, but we'll go now. And they go, I'm not coming here again. You might as well get it now. And they used to buy it. They used to take a carload home with them. So the wife was the secret salesperson.
Okay.
She was working for us and herself.